Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Dan Foster of National Review, pinch hitting for Jim Garrity today. And Dan, we certainly got what we wanted to see in the House. It wasn't quite as dramatic, I guess, as the vote last year because we knew it was going to happen. But the new Republican majority in the House passing the repeal of the president's health care plan. Now it goes on to the Senate. And while it certainly faces a much more iffy future there, we do have this promise coming from the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell.
I want to congratulate our colleagues in the House on this important first step. I hope the Senate will soon follow suit with a vote of its own. The Democratic leadership in the Senate doesn't want to vote on this bill, but I assure you, we will.
And Harry Reid has even suggested it might not even come to the floor, so there's a bunch of different options, I guess, that McConnell could use to force a vote on this. And even if it doesn't pass, we're going to get a lot of Democrats who are up in 2012 on the record on this once again, and that can only be good news, right?
Right, and that was a kind of an interesting side effect of the repeal vote, is you had a lot of Democrats who voted no on the bill last year, who survived that and voted to uphold the bill this year, so voted against repeal. So finally, they're all the blue dogs are on record for Obamacare. And I hope Senator McConnell's right that he can force a vote in the Senate. I don't know that he is, and I think that the problem there is that if he does get a vote, it will almost certainly be because Harry Reid is sure that it won't pass. And if Harry Reid has any doubts about that, then McConnell won't get a vote. So it's kind of a catch-22 there. So I'm not sure if that's going to happen. But you're right. The effort to get a vote, and if he does get a vote, will certainly reveal a lot of those on-the-fence Democrats one way or another.
Certainly true. And Harry Reid, of course, knows he's got the backstop of an Obama veto, which is absolutely assured if this thing were to get that far. But yeah, even if it doesn't get through the Senate, you're going to have folks like Jim Webb, if he decides to run again, like Claire McCaskill and some of these other people in relatively vulnerable states having to go on record yet again and then have that vote in front of them before the voters. It could be an opportunity for some of them to actually get the vote right and try to improve their reelection chances, but odds are that they won't actually do that, and so that could mean good things for Republicans next year. In terms of the debate as it played out in the House, Dan, you know, we heard just last week from the president and from just about everybody in the media to the point where we're sick of hearing it, that civility has got to take precedence here, and you can have honest differences of opinion, and you know, you just have to conduct yourself with dignity and maturity on the floor, and darn it, those conservative Republicans, you just got to get your act together. So just a couple hours into the first major debate since Congress got back to work after the tragedy in Tucson, well, looks like the civility pledge on the part of the Democrats didn't last very long. In fact, you can pretty much time it with a stopwatch. Here's Tennessee Democratic Congressman Steve Cohen from Memphis.
They say it's a government takeover of health care, a big lie, just like Goebbels. You say it enough, you repeat the lie, you repeat the lie, you repeat the lie, and eventually people believe it, like blood libel. That's the same kind of thing. The Germans said enough about the Jews, and the people believed it, and you had the Holocaust.
Can't be good for the future of civility, Dan, when we get to Goebbels and the Holocaust when talking about Republican rhetoric in just the first couple hours.
No, sir, and it wasn't even an implication. It wasn't even a sly, subtle suggestion of a commonality. He said, just like Goebbels. The Republicans are just like Goebbels. And then, you know, when I first heard that soundbite, I only heard the first part. It was a few hours later that I got the full thing about blood libel, then you get the Holocaust. It was one of those step A, repeal health care, step B, dot, 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 step three, Holocaust type argument. And I mean, what else can you say about it? It was idiotic. The worst part about these reductio ad Hitlerum arguments is not even necessarily how absurd they are, but how cliche they've become. I mean, you can't really get anywhere now by comparing somebody to Hitler, because it's almost par for the course at this point. And both sides have done it, but Cohen just did it so baldly and so, you know, without any artifice, that it's just absolutely ridiculous.
Hard to believe that he's getting away with that to any extent. There has been a little bit of rebuke from some corners of the media, but I've yet to hear anything from the president, anything from Nancy Pelosi, anything from those who are really just throwing firebombs at Sarah Palin and everybody else, like Rush Limbaugh, a couple of weeks ago. They seem to be curiously silent on this one.
No, and compare this comment to the death panels,
right.
You know, narrative. Well, the death panels, you can say that maybe that was a little overhyped, but certainly based in what's in the bill, and might be a somewhat melodramatic way of describing one of the outcomes of these Medicare review boards, end of life review boards. But there's a basis and policy fact here, and there's a worry about where this sort of thing could head. Whereas Cohen's just straight up comparing Republicans to Nazis, and everything we heard about death panels and just pure silence here.
Exactly right. So on to the third martini now, and this one could be good, could be bad. I guess we'll find out exactly 2 years from today, because today, Dan, of course, is the exact middle point of either President Obama's presidency or his first term, depending on what happens in November of next year. If you look at the midterm results, it looks like it's the midway point of his presidency, but his poll numbers seem to be rebounding a bit. But what's your sense on where we stand right now and whether this guy's likely to be a one-termer or a two-termer?
Well, I think that he's such a good... I've always thought, from sort of January 21st, 2009, I've thought that he's such a good campaigner. And you look at the Republican field, and it's just not clear if there's a guy who's both a sufficiently good operator and a sufficiently good operator and a sufficiently good policy person to be able to take him on. But, people surprise you, and I suspect that we don't even know. I suspect we may not even be talking about who the Republican nominee is going to end up being in 2012. 2 years is a long time. It's an eternity in politics. And I think it could go either way, but I've always suspected that it will be an uphill battle to beat Obama. And incumbent presidents have a lot on their side. They fully control the architecture of their party, the DNC. They have a great infrastructure, and both Republicans and Democrats do it, but they can use the White House in ways that the incumbent can't use. So there are just a lot of structural advantages for Democrats. And in terms of how he's handling himself, well, we've seen this year the feints to the center, and some of them are less substantive. For instance, this op-ed he wrote in the Wall Street Journal about how we're going to have to take a look at, the president wrote, about how we're going to have to take a look at regulations, except the regulations in Obamacare and the regulations in the financial reform bill are not going to be touched. Two massive over-regulations of American industries are not going to be touched. So some look less substantive. But if, on the other hand, the president shows up at the State of the Union in a couple of weeks or next week and says, we're going to simplify the tax code and we're going to look at some real spending cuts and we're going to work with Republicans on these things, well, then not only will those be more substantive if he sticks to his word on that, but they will also help him in 2012.
Certainly will. I think, and this is not exactly cogent or exclusive political analysis here, but it's going to boil down to two things. Number one, the state of the economy, specifically the unemployment rate, which by all indicators is likely to improve regardless of whether his policies have anything to do with that or not. And the other thing, of course, is the strength of the Republican candidate. We saw with Bill Clinton, who voters clearly didn't like. They still didn't give him 50% in 1996, but
right.
We basically sent the standard bearer out there, Bob Dole, as kind of, well, it's his turn, rather than a guy that the party is really fired up about, and certainly the middle of the country was fired up about, and it didn't work. So a lot of different things that need to come together here.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, is that the Republicans have a much bigger tradition of it's this guy's turn when it comes to running presidential candidates, and the Democrats don't so much have that problem, and I think that's to their advantage.
So we will find out exactly how this all plays out. Happy midpoint of the administration, hopefully, and if not the first term. Dan, thanks for being with us today. Have a great week.
Thanks, Greg.
Dan Foster of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the 3 Martini Lunch.